Hello and welcome. We're back to discuss tonight our third lecture on the issue of consideration, legality, and now public policy. That's going to be what tonight's discussion is going to be on. As you know, we discussed and opened in our first lecture tonight on consideration. Consideration is a promise for a promise. It's getting value. It can be positive. Remember, you can do an act or provide a service or provide something of value like money, or it can be something negative. You can refrain from doing something that you have a legal right to do, which is a forbearance. It does have some exceptions, as we discussed. But overall, you need generally to have consideration to have a valid contract. And every contract, of course, has to be for a legal purpose subject matter. And we discussed what that means and how you have to make sure that the both the subject of the contract as well as its terms are in compliance with the law. And tonight we're going to talk about public policy now, because just like not all illegal contracts are crimes, and some of them are what we call civil wrongs, which are torts. Along that line is the courts sometimes refuse on public policy grounds to try and protect society as a whole to not have contracts go into certain areas or for certain purposes. And we'll discuss that this evening. Let's jump right in. We're going to first do some definitions, then we're going to do some general principles on what public policy is, and then we're going to talk a bit about public policy in terms of business regulation and consumer statutes. And we're going to start again with some definitions. Again, this is somewhat repetitious, but it's important. Repetition is the mother of learning, that we're going to have what is the definition of a contract? Because that's what this class is about. It's about contracts. A contract is an agreement. That's the fundamental linchpin of any contract, that it's an agreement between two or more parties, and it creates obligations that are enforceable or otherwise recognizable at law. Those obligations include the consideration that we talked about previously. Again, what are the elements of the contract? First and foremost, out of the box, it's got to be an agreement. And you got to have competent parties, because there has to be a level of understanding in order to have that agreement. So the parties have to be of age. They have to be over 18 years of age, the age of majority. They have to be of a sound mind and body. As a result of this, they need to have their mental faculties. They can't be intoxicated. They can't be of mental disease or defect, because those things can impair your ability to understand what the terms of the contract are. And if you don't understand them, then you can't agree to them. And that agreement is based on genuine assent. That means the two parties actually agree. They understand what they're agreeing to, and they take on that agreement and agree to it. It's got to be supported by consideration, as we said. You have to give a promise for a promise, a something for a something, because otherwise it's not a contract, it's a gift, or it is merely an offer. And in order to make it a contract, you have to give something, which is consideration. As we just discussed, it's got to be for a lawful purpose subject matter. You can't have a contract that's enforceable to do a criminal act or to do a tort or something that's unconscionable, which is so grossly unfair that it shocks the conscience of the court. And lastly, it's got to be in legal form, which means that if it is required by something like the statute of frauds, it needs to be in writing. Under some legal requirements, it's got to be notarized. That means a notary public's got to take your signature and say that is the person who signed it. So it's got to be in legal form. What's the definition of legality in public policy? As we discussed last time, a valid contract must be for a legal purpose subject matter. Well, contracts which are deemed invalid because of public policy are the same as those which fail for a lack of a legal purpose subject matter. Because whereas the legal purpose subject matter can fail because it's a crime or it's a tort, here it's a violation of public policy, which means good societal standards that we want to do to help everyone. What is public policy? According to Black's Law Dictionary, it's principles and standards regarding by the legislature or by the courts as being a fundamental concern of the state and the whole of society. It's something that benefits everybody. And whereas we prevent certain contracts that would hurt everybody if they're allowed to take place. Now, may not be specifically illegal, but is a matter of law, it's a good idea to either prohibit or not to enforce these contracts. This was discussed under British law as way back as 1824, when case said, when they argued this case, it was said there was no consideration. And if there was, it was illegal. And if it was illegal, it must have been illegal either on the ground that it was against public policy or against some particular law. I, for one, protest, this is what the judge said, against arguing too strongly for public policy. Why? It is a very much unruly horse, he says. And once you are astride it, you never know where it will carry you. It may lead you from the sound law. It never is argued at all, but when all other points fail. It's basically a catch-all. When I can't find a law that it violates so that it's illegal, I argue public policy, he says. So it's not something that's frequently used by courts. And even in here, the courts kind of make fun of it because it doesn't have a concrete standard, but it is something which is a catch-all that can protect society as a whole. Let's talk about its general principles. The law will not recognize certain agreements that a legislature or the courts deem are substantially against the public interest and that are harmful to society as a whole. These agreements that may harm the public welfare are condemned as being contrary to public policy. But what kind of agreements are those that aren't upheld? Agreements that interfere with the public service of duties of public officials, that obstruct legal process, or discriminate against certain types of individuals. Those kind of things that are so unseemly, that are not beneficial for society. They may or may not be illegal, but they're something that shouldn't be condoned by society. And a contract that puts them in should be struck down. Agreements contrary to public policy may not violate any specific statute, but may be so offensive to society that the courts feel that enforcing that contract would not be a good idea. As the unruly horse comparison is, and remember that was written in 1824, so there were a lot of horses back then, an unruly horse. Today we might say a car that's out of control, but back then they described it as an unruly horse. One of the reasons for that is there's no clear delineation. It's what the court find is for the benefit of society as a whole. Well, that's a very subjective standard, and public policy cannot be defined precisely as a result of that. But there are certain benchmarks by which the courts will follow. One, it's got to be for society's protection, the protection of the public welfare or health or safety. It could be for personal protection, the protections of persons or their property, or it could be an institutional protection for certain societal institutions such as charities or hospitals, things like that. As we said, courts are very hesitant to use this remedy because of the fact that you're invalidating a contract, you're pairing freedom of contract on a rather amorphous standard. And they like when you have a standard that's a lot stronger than that, but this is an all else catch-all type of circumstance where they'll do it when and if they only have to. One of the typical areas of contract that they will not uphold in the courts is one that is against gambling or wagering or lotteries. Now, gambling is generally illegal. New York State is unconstitutional. Certain Indian casinos in the state of New York are able to operate gambling houses, but nobody else can. We don't have casino gambling or free gambling or sports betting or things like that unless you are part of the state, or we do it for certain Indian tribes because they're treated under our state constitution as a foreign nation. So that's not part of the state property. Now, similarly, private lotteries and raffles, which are violative of public policy, if I have a contract to do a private lottery or raffle, guess what? That's a violation of law and you can't do it. But again, the state can. So you can buy a state lotto ticket. You can buy a Powerball ticket because that's an exception. Bingo and certain charities are allowed. So if it's a charitable organization, they're allowed to host a bingo and they can charge for that. And you can have that for a charitable purpose. Similarly, a sweepstakes where I sell a ticket is viewed as a raffle. And as a result of that, that's against the law. But if I don't charge for the ticket, I do it as a promotion for my business. Come inside and look at my cars and sign up and you can win $100 or win a new TV set or win a car. As long as you don't have to purchase anything to get that entry into that sweepstakes, it's perfectly legal. The second you have to purchase something for that, that's why whenever you hear about these sweepstakes, you generally hear the disclaimer, no purchase necessary. Well, the reason for that is if you don't charge for the ticket, you can hold it. If you don't, then it is viewed as gambling, which is illegal. Skilled activity, by the way, is not viewed as gambling because gambling is really something of luck. So as a result, something that's predominantly skilled, like a shooting contest or some kind of contest whereby you use some degree of skill, that is not viewed as gambling. Whereas something like a card draw, which is solely a matter of luck, is viewed as a gambling, and hence you cannot have a contract to enforce it. As you can see, this is a kind of a nice chart with respect to certain areas which are prohibited as a matter of public policy. You have illegal wages and lotteries, discrimination, obstructions to legal process, conflicts of interest, illegal lobbying, injuries to public service, evasions of statutory protection, prejudice to public policy. all these agreements are not enforceable as a matter of law because they violate society's protection as a whole. Let's talk now about business regulation, because this is a very important area today. Things like consumer statutes allow for contracts not to be enforceable or to have them only partially enforced so that consumers are protected. Generally, business regulations provide that you have a regulatory scheme to balance the interests of business with those of public as a whole. These laws can take the from everything from licensing to operational limitations on the business and its employees to disclosure requirements, things that they have to tell their customers, to consumer protection consumer protection legislation. The effect of the violation is to make that contract not binding or partially binding only, or void altogether. And it depends on how strongly opposed the public policy is from the prohibited act that that business is undertaking. Most courts take the view that the agreement is not void unless the statute expressly states that it is. And as a result, sometimes it's only partially, or sometimes there's other kinds of limitations. With respect to these consumer protection statutes, they can require uniformity in their contracts so that people have a plain meaning, so they can understand it in the English language to protect the parties to a contract so that they understand what they can go in. So they can require a uniform statutory language. There's also these consumer protection statutes that give the customer the right to rescind the contract over a certain period of time. The New York State Lemon Law is a good example. If you buy a car and it is a real lemon, as they call it, you can return the car and get your money back. There's truth in lending statutes. There's statutes with respect to installment sales. I buy a refrigerator and I only have to pay X dollars a month to bring it home. Home improvement contracts, for example, have a high level of consumer protection. There are certain businesses and certain professions which have to be licensed in order to operate. As a lawyer, I have to pass the bar exam to show my level of proficiency in the law, that I understand enough. I had to take the bar exam in order to be licensed to practice. Similarly, a physician has to do the same thing. They have to pass his medical boards in order to maintain their medical license to practice medicine. That is also true with other trades that require a high degree of education or training or skill in order to be deemed proficient. Just like you don't want me doing your plumbing in your house, you don't want your plumber to be your attorney. So you have to be licensed and skilled in what you're doing, whether it be law or medicine or accountancy, real estate brokers, stock brokers, insurance agents, even hotel keepers have to be able to pass some degree of an examination to show their proficiency. You know, electricians, you don't want your house burning down. Plumbers, you don't want it flooding. So in most jurisdictions, a license is required in order to practice these professions or trades and in order to protect the public from unqualified people trying to do this. Contracts with unlicensed persons are unenforceable, particularly for the person who is the unlicensed contractor. So if a person goes out and is not an attorney licensed to practice in New York and tries to write you a will and then charge you, that contract's unenforceable on that. Now, there is a doctrine in the law called quantum merit. Quantum merit is an equitable remedy. It's not a legal remedy. It's, again, for equity, which says we delight to do justice, we want to be fair, that allows a person who performs services to recover the reasonable amount of the services that they perform and any damages incurred in compensation for the work they perform. Certain businesses, however, say you don't get quantum merit because you have to be licensed for that. Quantum merit does go to somebody who is licensed, but won't go to someone who isn't. So the license issue will take right away from the ability of a contractor to say, hey, I did that work, I ought to get paid for it. If he is licensed or she does have that certificate or that ability to practice and demonstrated that facility, then the quantum merit can apply, which means if they do the work, equity demands they get some degree of remuneration for it. But if they don't have a license, they don't have that ability to get quantum merit. There are certain times when you have a contract that will seek to restrain trade. They are not a contract which is something that is upheld and enforceable. Restraint of trade contracts interfere with the competition of the free market. They interfere with our ability to be able to do free capitalistic trades. And they are strongly disliked by the courts. The restraint of trade agreement, I turn around and do a monopoly, or I do a contract that says you won't sell to this person, building what used to be known as trusts. And those are deemed illegal. Not only are they illegal under common law, but there's also anti-trade and restraint of trade statutes. The Sherman Antitrust Law, as well as state statutes such as the Martin Act, provide that monopolies can't operate, that you cannot build a monopoly, you can't restrain trades. So any contract basically that provides for the restraint of trade is generally deemed as illegal under law, not just under these statutes, but under common law again. Now, that's not to be confused with restraint of trade goes against everybody. Agreements not to compete in certain circumstances. I agree, I'm not going to compete with you. That can be upheld, but they're disfavored for the same reason as the contracts and restraint of trade aren't going to be upheld. Agreements not to compete, which is anti-competitive, anti-capitalism, and those contracts also are not favored by the courts, but they're allowable in certain circumstances, particularly when you have a former employment relationship or if you have some kind of business agreement with them. But there's certain standards that have to be met in order for them to be enforced. Number one, it's got to be narrowly drawn to protect a legitimate business interest. It can't just be overly broad, because if it is, it won't be upheld. It can't be unduly burdensome for that person's ability to earn a living who is signs that agreement not to compete. The geographic restriction can't be overly broad. Generally, it's got to be something like 1 year and 1 mile because otherwise it's deemed as too broad. And It's got to be a reasonable time on that. As I said, it's got to be narrow. It's got to be focused on the two parties. And when it is narrow, when it is focused, you know, 1 year and 1 mile, I can't compete, then something like that will be upheld under the court. Why do we do this? Why would we uphold any of them? Well, certain agreements not to compete are put in place because the employee relationship specifically, and this most often happens in employment relationships, but generally there's circumstances where that person has made quite an investment in that person, and then they want to leave for a competitor, or they're going out and it's going to be incredibly difficult to replace them, and they put a lot of investment in it. So it's viewed primarily that this cannot be overly broad, that if you have a circumstance where, you know, I put a lot of money into you, I trained you, I educated you in all of these circumstances, now you're leaving me to go to a competitor who's going to get all the investment that I put into you, they're going to get that benefit. Well, if you could say, hey, listen, don't compete with me for a year or within a mile of the store, that's viewed as reasonable. You know, 50 years and 50 miles, not so much. So again, contracts and restraint of trade generally are not enforceable at all. Agreements not to compete, if they are narrowly drawn and limited, they can be upheld. Lastly, usury. Usury is where you have a circumstance where a contract, and it's generally to lend money, has interest rates caps on it. It's legally defined as charging an illegally high rate of interest. At common law, incidentally, back a long, long time ago, it was charging any interest rate. But today, it's an illegally high rate of interest. There are usury statutes in every state. There's in New York State, it's what is known as the legal rate of interest. The general obligations law has civil usury of 16%. Anything above 16% is non-enforceable under the civil usury statute. Criminal usury is above 25%. So if you turn around and charge more than 25%, then that's a crime in addition to being non-enforceable. Now, there are certain transactions that aren't subject to civil usury. Those also include credit cards. And the federal courts have said that interest rates for credit cards, primarily because most of these credit card companies are federally regulated, not state regulated, that they're not subject to that usury rate of 16%, and hence can go all the way up to that 25%, because the federally chartered banking institutions are not subject to the state usury laws. Sometimes over and above the lending of money, you have what is known as usurious agreements. Whereas I have an agreement, which although it's not an agreement to lend money, it ends up being that by means of a different manner. I buy a house from you, you're basically going to provide me the financing for that as a part of the sale. If you get a interest rate as a part of that contract that's above the usury rate, then that can be viewed as a usury contract. There are, however, several exemptions, as we said, not just the credit cards, but very large loans can be exempted. A loan or forbearance above $2.5 million is exempt from both criminal and civil usury. Why? Because it's such a large amount of money, and they view that the only people who are going to be lending and taking this loan are going to be arm's length sophisticated people. And similarly, a loan or forbearance of $250,000 is generally exempt from civil usury. So, you know, that's a large amount of money, and again, for the same reason. Certain Article 9 transactions, which are secured transactions under the UCC, are exempt from civil and criminal usury if the amount is under 8% above prime, and that's in Article 9 of the UCC. Defaulted obligations, when they go to collect on a debt, that also is exempted from civil usury. So as a result of that, usury is in the law, it is enforced, but there are a whole boatload of exceptions. And by and large, remember the rates of 16 and 25%, those are the caps. And as a result of that, you know, even though there are certain exceptions, like a credit card and like these high-end loans, by and large, it's still the law. This is another chart which specifies all these things on business regulation, the conflicts of interest which are prohibited, fraudulent sales, contracts with unlicensed persons that we talked about, agreements in restraining trade and not to compete, obstructions to legal process. Those contracts are struck down. And lastly, usurious agreements. They're all not going to be enforced as a matter of law. Now we're going to go on to our case, which is a very interesting case. It's all about consideration, and it's Allegheny College versus National Chautauqua Bank. It's consideration, and we'll see you in a moment.